I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin, too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Chapter 4 of She and Alan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. She and Alan by H. Rider Haggard. Chapter 4. The Lion and the Axe. Next day early, I left the town of the people of the Axe, having bid a formal farewell to Umslopogaas, saying in a voice that all could hear, that as the rivers were still flooded, I proposed to trek to the northern parts of Zululand and trade there until the weather was better. Our private arrangement, however, was that on the night of the next full moon, which happened about 4 weeks later, we should meet at the eastern foot of a certain great flat-topped mountain known to both of us, which stands to the north of Zululand, but well beyond its borders. So northward I trekked, slowly to spare my oxen, trading as I went. The details do not matter, but as it happened I met with more luck upon that journey than had come my way for many a long year. Although I worked on credit, since nearly all my goods were sold, as owing to my repute I could always do in Zululand. I made some excellent bargains in cattle, and to top up with, bought a large lot of ivory so cheap that really I think it must have been stolen. All of this, cattle and ivory together, I sent to Natal in charge of a white friend of mine whom I could trust, where the stuff was sold very well indeed, and the proceeds paid to my account, the trade equivalents being duly remitted to the native vendors. In fact, my good fortune was such that if I had been superstitious like Hans, I should have been inclined to attribute it to the influence of Sikali's great medicine. As it was, I knew it to be one of the chances of a trader's life, and accepted it with a shrug as often as I had been accustomed to do in the alternative of losses. Only one untoward incident happened to me. Of a sudden, party of the king's soldiers under the command of a well-known Induna or counsellor arrived and insisted upon searching my wagon, as I thought at first in connection with that cheap lot of ivory which had already departed to Natal. However, never a word did they say of ivory, nor indeed was a single thing belonging to me taken by them. I was very indignant and expressed my feelings to the Induna in no measured terms. He, on his part, was most apologetic, and explained that what he did he was obliged to do by the king's orders. Also he let it slip that he was seeking for a certain evil-doer, who, it was thought, might be with me, without my knowing his real character, and as this evil-doer, whose name he would not mention, was a very fierce man, it had been necessary to bring a strong guard with him. Now I bethought me of Umslopogaas, but merely looked blank and shrugged my shoulders, saying that I was not in the habit of consorting with evil-doers. Still unsatisfied, the Induna questioned me as to the places where I had been during this journey of mine in the Zulu country. I told him with the utmost frankness, mentioning, among others, because I was sure that already he knew all my movements well, the town of the people of the Axe. Then he asked me if I had seen its chief, a certain Umslopogaas, or Bulalio. I answered yes, that I had met him there for the first time, and thought him a very remarkable man. With this the Induna agreed emphatically, saying that perhaps I did not know how remarkable. Next he asked me where he was now, to which I replied that I had not the faintest idea, but I presumed in his kraal, where I had left him. The Induna explained that he was not in his kraal, that he had gone away leaving one Lousta and his own head wife Monasi to administer the chieftainship for a while, because, as he stated, he wished to make a journey. I yawned as if weary of the subject of this chief, and indeed of the whole business. Then the Induna said that I must come to the king and repeat to him all the words that I had spoken. I replied that I could not possibly do so, as, having finished my trading, I had arranged to go north to shoot elephants. He answered that elephants lived a long while and would not die while I was visiting the king. Then followed an argument which grew heated, and ended in his declaring that to the king I must come, even if he had to take me there by force. I sat silent, wondering what to say or do, and leant forward to pick a piece of wood out of the fire wherewith to light my pipe. Now my shirt was not buttoned, and as it chanced this action caused the ivory image of Sikali that hung about my neck to appear between its edges. The Induna saw it, and his eyes grew big with fear. "Hide that," he whispered, "hide that, lest it should bewitch me. Indeed, already I feel as though I were being bewitched. It is the great medicine itself." "That will certainly happen to you," I said, yawning again, "if you insist upon my taking a week's trek to visit the Black One, or interfere with me in any way, now or afterwards," and I lifted my hand towards the talisman, looking him steadily in the face. "Perhaps, after all, Macumazahn, it is not necessary for you to visit the king," he said in an uncertain voice. "I will go and make report to him that you know nothing of this evil-doer." And he went in such a hurry that he never waited to say good-bye. Next morning, before the dawn, I went also, and trekked steadily until I was clear of Zululand. In due course and without accident, for the weather, which had been so wet, had now turned beautifully fine and dry, we came to the great flat-topped hill that I have mentioned, trekking thither over a high, sparsely timbered weald that offered few difficulties to the wagon. This peculiar hill, known to such natives as lived in those parts by a long word that means hut with a flat roof, is surrounded by forest, for here trees grow wonderfully well, perhaps because of the water that flows from its slopes. Forcing our way through this forest, which was full of game, I reached its eastern foot, and there camped, 5 days before that night of full moon, on which I had arranged to meet Umslopogaas. That I should meet him I did not in the least believe, firstly because I thought it very probable that he would have changed his mind about coming, and secondly for the excellent reason that I expected he had gone to call upon the king against his will, as I had been asked to do. It was evident to me that he was up to his eyes in some serious plot against Cetywayo, in which he was the old dwarf Sikali's partner, or rather tool. Also that his plot had been betrayed, with the result that he was wanted, and would have little chance of passing safely through Zululand. So, taking one thing with another, I imagined that I had seen his grim face and his peculiar, ancient-looking axe for the last time. To tell the truth, I was glad. Although at first the idea had appealed to me a little, I did not want to make this wild goose or wild witch chase through unknown lands to seek for a totally fabulous person who dwelt far across the Zambesi. I had, as it were, been forced into the thing, but if Umslopogaas did not appear, my obligations would be at an end, and I should return to Natal at my leisure. First, however, I would do a little shooting, since I found that a large herd of elephants haunted this forest. Indeed, I was tempted to attack them at once, but did not do so, since, as Hans pointed out, if we were going north, it would be difficult to carry the ivory, especially if we had to leave the wagon, and I was too old a hunter to desire to kill the great beasts for the fun of the thing. So I just sat down and rested, letting the oxen feed throughout the hours of light on the rich grasses which grew upon the bottommost slopes of the big mountain, where we were camped by a stream not more than 100 yards above the timber line. At some time or other there had been a native village at this spot. Probably the Zulus had cleaned it out in long past years, for I found human bones black with age lying in the long grass. Indeed, the cattle kraal still remained, and in such good condition that my piling up a few stones here and there on the walls and closing the narrow entrances with thorn bushes, we could still use it to enclose our oxen at night. This I did for fear lest there should be lions about, though I had neither seen nor heard them. So the days went by pleasantly enough, with lots to eat, since whenever we wanted meat I had only to go a few yards to shoot a fat buck at a spot whither they trekked to drink in the evening, till at last came the time of full moon. Of this I was also glad, since, to tell the truth, I had begun to be bored. Rest is good, but for a man who has always led an active life, too much of it is very bad, for then he begins to think, and thought in large doses is depressing. Of the fire-eating Umslopogaas there was no sign, so I made up my mind that on the morrow I would start after those elephants, and when I had shot, or failed to shoot, some of them, return to Natal. I felt unable to remain idle any more. It never was my gift to do so, which is perhaps why I employ my ample leisure here in England in jotting down such reminiscences as these. Well, the full moon came up in silver glory, and after I had taken a good look at her for luck, also at all the veld within sight, I turned in. An hour or two later some noise from the direction of the cattle kraal woke me up. As it did not recur, I thought that I would go to sleep again. Then an uneasy thought came to me that I could not remember having looked to see whether the entrance was properly closed, as it was my habit to do. It was the same sort of troublesome doubt which in a civilized house makes a man get out of bed and go along the cold passages to the sitting-room to see whether he has put out the lamp. It always proves that he has put it out, but that does not prevent a repetition of the performance next time the perplexity arises. I reflected that perhaps the noise was caused by the oxen pushing their way through the carelessly closed entrance, and at any rate that I had better go to see. So I slipped on my boots and a coat, and went without waking Hans or the boys, only taking with me a loaded single-barreled rifle, which I used for shooting small buck, but no spare cartridges. Now, in front of the gateway of the cattle kraal, shading it, grew a single big tree of the wild fig order. Passing under this tree, I looked and saw that the gateway was quite securely closed, as now I remembered I had noted at sunset. Then I started to go back, but had not stepped more than 2 or 3 paces, when, in the bright moonlight, I saw the head of my smallest ox, a beast of the Zulu breed, suddenly appear over the top of the wall. About this there would have been nothing particularly astonishing, had it not been for the fact that his head belonged to a dead animal, as I could tell from the closed eyes and the hanging tongue. "What in the name of goodness," I began to myself, when my reflections were cut short by the appearance of another head, that of one of the biggest lions I ever saw, which had the ox by the throat, and with the enormous strength that is given to these creatures, by getting its back beneath the body, was deliberately hoisting it over the wall to drag it away to devour at its leisure. There was the brute within 12 feet of me, and what is more, it saw me as I saw it and stopped, still holding the ox by the throat. What a chance for Allan Quatermain! Of course he shot it dead. One can fancy anyone saying, who knows me by repute, also that by the gift of God I am handy with a rifle. Well, indeed it should have been, for even with the small boar piece that I carried, a bullet ought to have pierced through the soft parts of its throat to the brain, and to have killed that lion as dead as Julius Caesar. Theoretically, the thing was easy enough. Indeed, although I was startled for a moment, by the time that I had the rifle onto my shoulder, I had little fear of the issue, unless there was a misfire, especially as the beast seemed so astonished that it remained quite still. Then the unexpected happened, as generally it does in life, particularly in hunting, which in my case is a part of life. I fired, but by misfortune the bullet struck the tip of the horn of that confounded ox, which tip either was or at that moment fell in front of the spot of the lion's throat, where it half unconsciously I had aimed. Result? The ball was turned and, departing at an angle, just cut the skin of the lion's neck deeply enough to hurt it very much and to make it madder than all the hatters in the world. Dropping the ox with the most terrific roar, it came over the wall at me. I remembered that there seemed to be yards of it, I mean of the lion, in front of which appeared a cavernous mouth full of gleaming teeth. I skipped back with much agility, also a little to one side, because there was nothing else to do, reflecting in a kind of inconsequent way that after all Zikali's great medicine was not worth a curse. The lion landed on my side of the wall and reared itself upon its hind legs before getting to business, towering high above me, but slightly to my left. Then I saw a strange thing. A shadow thrown by the moon flitted past me. All I noted of it was the distorted shape of a great lifted axe, probably because the axe came first. The shadow fell, and with it another shadow, that of a lion's paw dropping to the ground. Next there was a most awful noise of roaring, and wheeling round I saw such a fray as never I shall see again. A tall, grim black man was fighting the great lion that now lacked one paw, but still stood upon its hind legs, striking at him with the other. The man, who was absolutely silent, dodged the blow and hit back with the axe, catching the beast upon the breast with such weight that it came to the ground in a loop-sided fashion, since now it had only one forefoot on which to light. The axe flashed up again, and before the lion could recover itself or do anything else, fell with a crash upon its skull, sinking deep into the head. After this all was over, for the beast's brain was cut in two.
"I am here at the appointed time, Macumazahn," said Umslopogaas, for it was he, as with difficulty he dragged his axe from the lion's severed skull, "to find you watching by night, as it is reported that you always do." "No," I retorted, for his tone irritated me. "You are late, Bulalio. The moon has been up some hours." "I said, O Macumazahn, that I would meet you on the night of the full moon, not at the rising of the moon."
"That is true," I replied, mollified. "And at any rate you came at a good moment."
"Yes," he answered, "though as it happens in this clear light the thing was easy to anyone who can handle an axe. Had it been darker, the end might have been different. But, Macumazahn, you are not so clever as I thought, since otherwise you would not have come out against a lion with a toy like that," and he pointed to the little rifle in my hand.
"I did not know that there was a lion, Umslopogaas."
"That is why you are not so clever as I thought, since of one sort or another there is always a lion which wise men should be prepared to meet, Macumazahn." "You are right again," I replied. At that moment Hans arrived upon the scene, followed at a discreet distance by the waggon boys, and took in the situation at a glance.
"The great medicine of the Opener of Roads has worked well," was all he said.
"The great medicine of the Opener of Heads has worked better," remarked Umslopogaas with a little laugh, and pointing to his red axe. "Never before since she came into my keeping has Inkosikaas, that is, Chieftainess, for so was this famous weapon named, sunk so low as to drink the blood of beasts. Still, the stroke was a good one, so she need not be shamed. But, Yellow Man, how comes it that you, who I have been told are cunning, watch your master so ill?"
"I was asleep," stuttered Hans indignantly.
"Those who serve should never sleep," replied Umslopogaas sternly. Then he turned and whistled, and behold, out of the long grass that grew at a little distance emerged 12 great men, all of them bearing axes and wearing cloaks of hyena skins, who saluted me by raising their axes.
"Set a watch and skin me this beast by dawn. It will make us a mat," said Umslopogaas,
whereon again they saluted silently and melted away.
"Who are these?" I asked.
"A few picked warriors whom I brought with me, Macumazahn. There were one or two more, but they got lost on the way."
Then we went to the wagon and spoke no more that night. Next morning I told Umslopogaas of the visit I had received from the Induna, of the king who wished me to come to the royal kraal. He nodded and said,
"As it chances, certain thieves attacked me on my journey, which is why one or two of my people remain behind, who will never travel again. We made good play with those thieves. Not one of them escaped," he added grimly, "and their bodies we threw into a river where are many crocodiles. But their spears I brought away, and I think they are such as the king's guard use. If so, his search for them will be long, since the fight took place where no man lives, and we burned the shields and trappings. Oho, he will think that the ghosts have taken them."
That morning we trekked on fast, fearing lest the regiment searching for these thieves should strike and follow our spoor. Luckily the ox that the lion had killed was one of some spare cattle which I was driving with me, so its loss did not inconvenience us. As we went, Umslopogaas told me that he had duly appointed Lousta and his wife Monazi to rule the tribe during his absence, an office which they accepted doubtfully, Monazi acting as chieftainess and Lousta as her head Induna or counsellor. I asked him whether he thought this wise under all the circumstances, seeing that it had occurred to me since I made the suggestion that they might be unwilling to surrender power on his return, also that other domestic complications might ensue.
"It matters little, Macumazahn," he said with a shrug of his great shoulders, "for of this I am sure, that I have played my part with the people of the axe, and to stop among them would have meant my death. Who am a man betrayed? What do I care who love none and now have no children? Still, it is true that I might have fled to Natal with the cattle, and there have led a fat and easy life. But ease and plenty I do not desire, who would live and fall as a warrior should. Never again, mayhap, shall I see the ghost mountain where the wolves raven and the old witch sits in stone waiting for the world to die, or sleep in the town of the people of the axe. What do I want with wives and oxens, while I have Inkosikaas, the groan maker, and she is true to me?" he added, shaking the ancient axe above his head, so that the sun gleamed upon the curved blade and the hollow gouge or point at the back beyond the shaft socket. "Where the axe goes, there go the strength and virtue of the axe, O Macumazahn."
"It is a strange weapon," I said.
"Aye, a strange and an old, forged far away," says Zikali, "by a warrior wizard, hundreds of years ago,
a great fighter who was also the first of smiths and who sits in the underworld waiting for it to return to his hand when his work is finished beneath the sun. That will be soon, Macumazahn, since Zikali told me that I am the last holder of the axe." "Did you then see the Opener of Roads?" I asked.
"Aye, I saw him. He it was who told me which way to go to escape from Zululand. Also, he laughed when he heard how the flooded rivers brought you to my kraal, and sent you a message in which he said that the spirit of a snake had told him that you tried to throw the great medicine into a pool, but were stopped by that snake whilst it was still alive. This, he said, you must do no more, lest he should send another snake to stop you."
"Did he?" I replied indignantly, for Zikali's power of seeing or learning about things that happened at a distance puzzled and annoyed me. Only Hans grinned and said,
"I told you so, Baas."
On we travelled from day to day, meeting with such difficulties and dangers as are common on roadless weld in Africa. But no more, for the grass was good, and there was plenty of game, of which we shot what we wanted for meat. Indeed, here in the back regions of what is known as Portuguese South East Africa, every sort of wild animal was so numerous that personally I wished we could turn our journey into a shooting expedition. But of this Umslopogaas, whom hunting bored, would not hear. In fact, he was much more anxious than myself to carry out our original purpose. When I asked him why, he answered because of something Zikali had told him. What this was, he would not say, except that in the country whither we wandered, he would fight a great fight and win much honour. Now, Umslopogaas was by nature a fighting man, one who took a positive joy in battle, and like an old Norseman, seemed to think that thus only could a man decorously die. This amazed me, a peaceful person who loves quiet at home. Still, I gave way, partly to please him, partly because I hoped that we might discover something of interest, and still more because, having once undertaken an enterprise, my pride prompted me to see it through. Now, while he was preparing to draw his map in the ashes, or afterwards, I forget which, Zikali had told me that when we drew near to the great river, we should come to a place on the edge of a bush veld that ran down to the river, where a white man lived, adding, after casting his bones and reading from them, that he thought this white man was a trekboer. This, I should explain, means a Dutchman who has travelled away from wherever he lived and made a home for himself in the wilderness, as some wandering spirit, and the desire to be free of authority often prompt these people to do. Also, after another inspection of his enchanted knuckle bones, he had declared that something remarkable would happen to this man or his family while I was visiting him. Lastly, in that map he drew in the ashes, the details of which were impressed so indelibly upon my memory, he had shown me where I should find the dwelling of this white man, of whom and of whose habitation doubtless he knew through the many spies who seemed to be at the service of all witch doctors, and more especially of Zikali, the greatest among them. Travelling by the sun and the compass, I had trekked steadily in the exact direction which he indicated, to find that in this useful particular he was well named as the Opener of Roads, since always before me I found a practicable path, although to the right or to the left there would have been none. Thus, when we came to mountains, it was at a spot where we discovered a pass. When we came to swamps, it was where a ridge of high ground ran between, and so forth. Also, such tribes as we met upon our journey always proved of a friendly character, although perhaps the aspect of Umslopogaas and his fierce band, whom, rather irreverently, I named his 12 apostles, had a share in inducing this peaceful attitude. So smooth was our progress, and so well marked by water at certain intervals, that at last I came to the conclusion that we must be following some ancient road, which at a forgotten period of history had run from south to north, or vice versa. Or rather, to be honest, It was the observant Hans who made this discovery from various indications which had escaped my notice. I need not stop to detail them, but one of these was that at certain places the water holes on a high, rather barren land had been dug out, and in one or more instances lined with stones after the fashion of an ancient well. Evidently we were following an old trade route made, perhaps, in forgotten ages when Africa was more civilized than it is now. Passing over certain high misty lands during the third week of our trek, where frequently at this season of the year the sun never showed itself before 10 o'clock and disappeared at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and where twice we were held up for 2 whole days by dense fog, we came across a queer nomadic people who seemed to live in movable grass huts and to keep great herds of goats and long-tailed sheep. These folk ran away from us at first, but when they found that we did them no harm, became friendly and brought us offerings of milk, also of a kind of slug or caterpillar which they seemed to eat. Hans, who was a great master of different native dialects, discovered a tongue or a mixture of tongues in which he could make himself understood to some of them. They told him that in their day they had never seen a white man, although their fathers' fathers, an expression by which they meant their remote ancestors, had known many of them. They added, however, that if we went on steadily towards the north for another 7 days' journey, we should come to a place where a white man lived, one they had heard who had a long beard and killed animals with guns, as we did. Encouraged by this intelligence, we pushed forward, now travelling downhill, out of the mists into a more genial country. Indeed, the veld here was beautiful, high, rolling plains like those of the East African plateau, covered with a deep and fertile chocolate-coloured soil, as we could see where the rains had washed out at Dongas. The climate, too, seemed to be cool and very healthful. Altogether, it was a pity to see such lands lying idle and tenanted only by countless herds of game, for there were not any native inhabitants, or at least we met none. On we trekked, our road still sloping slightly downhill, till at length we saw far away a vast sea of bush veld, which, as I guessed correctly, must fringe the great Zambesi River. Moreover, we, or rather Hans, whose eyes were those of a hawk, saw something else, namely buildings of a more or less civilized kind, which stood among trees by the side of a stream, several miles on this side of the great belt of bush. "Look, Baas," said Hans, "those wonders did not lie. There is the house of the white man. I wonder if he drinks anything stronger than water," he added with a sigh and a kind of reminiscent contraction of his yellow throat. As it happened, he did. End of chapter 4 of She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Read by Lars Rolander.
Chapter 5 of She and Allan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Chapter 5. Ines. We had sighted the house from far away shortly after sunrise, and by midday we were there. As we approached, I saw that it stood almost immediately beneath 2 great baobab trees, babian trees we call them in South Africa, perhaps because monkeys eat their fruit. It was a thatched house with whitewashed walls and a stoop or veranda around it, apparently of the ordinary Dutch type. Moreover, beyond it, at a little distance, were other houses, or rather shanties, with wagon sheds, etc., and beyond, and mixed up with these, a number of native huts. Further on were considerable fields, green with springing corn. Also we saw herds of cattle grazing on the slopes. Evidently our white man was rich. Umslopogaas surveyed the place with a soldier's eye and said to me,
"This must be a peaceful country, Macumazahn, where no attack is feared, since of defence I see none."
"Yes," I answered, "why not? With a wilderness behind it and bush veld and a great river in front?"
"Men can cross rivers and travel through bush veld," he answered and was silent.
Up to this time we had seen no one, although it might have been presumed that a wagon trekking towards the house was a sufficiently unusual sight to have attracted attention.
"Where can they be?" I asked. "Asleep, Baas, I think," said Hans, and as a matter of fact he was right.
The whole population of the place was indulging in a noonday siesta. At last we came so near to the house that I halted the wagon and descended from the driving box in order to investigate. At this moment someone did appear, the sight of whom astonished me not a little, namely, a very striking-looking young woman. She was tall, handsome, with large dark eyes, good features, a rather pale complexion, and I think the saddest face that I ever saw. Evidently she had heard the noise of the wagon and had come out to see what caused it, for she had nothing on her head, which was covered with thick hair of a raven blackness. Catching sight of the great Umslopogaas with his gleaming axe and of his savage-looking bodyguard, she uttered an exclamation and not unnaturally turned to fly. "It's all right," I sang out, emerging from behind the oxen, and in English, though before the words had left my lips, I reflected that there was not the slightest reason to suppose that she would understand them. Probably she was Dutch or Portuguese, although by some instinct I had addressed her in English. To my surprise she answered me in the same tongue, spoken, it is true, with a peculiar accent which I could not place, as it was neither Scotch nor Irish.
"Thank you," she said. "I, sir, was frightened. Your friends look..."
Here she stumbled for a word, then added,
"ferocious."
I laughed at this composite adjective and answered,
"Well, so they are in a way, though they will not harm you or me. But, young lady, tell me, can we outspan here? Perhaps your husband..." "I have no husband. I have only a father, sir," and she sighed.
"Well, then, could I speak to your father? My name is Allan Quatermain, and I am making a journey of exploration to find out about the country beyond, you know."
"Yes, I will go to wake him. He's asleep. Everyone sleeps here at midday, except me," she said with another sigh.
"Why do you not follow their example?" I asked jocosely, for this young woman puzzled me and I wanted to find out about her.
"Because I sleep little, sir, who thinks too much. There will be plenty of time to sleep soon for all of us, will there not?"
I stared at her and inquired her name, because I did not know what else to say.
"My name is Inez Robertson," she answered. "I will go to wake my father. Meanwhile, please unyoke your oxen. They can feed with the others. They look as though they wanted rest, poor things."
Then she turned and went into the house. "Inez Robertson," I said to myself. "That's a queer combination. English father and Portuguese mother, I suppose. But what can an Englishman be doing in a place like this?" If it had been a trek boer, I should not have been surprised. Then I began to give directions about outspanning. We had just got the oxen out of the jokes when a big, raw-boned, red-bearded, blue-eyed, roughly clad man about 50 years of age appeared from the house, yawning. I threw my eye over him as he advanced with a peculiar rolling gait, and formed certain conclusions. A drunkard who has once been a gentleman, I reflected to myself, for there was something peculiarly dissolute in his appearance. Also one who has had to do with the sea.
a diagnosis which proved very accurate. "How do you do, Mr. Allan Quatermain, which I think my daughter said is your name, unless I dreamt it, for it is one that I seem to have heard before," he exclaimed with a broad Scotch accent which I do not attempt to reproduce. "What in the name of the blaze brings you here, where no real white man has been for years? Well, I'm glad enough to see you anyway, for I'm sick of half-breed Portuguese and niggers and snuff and butter girls and gin and bad whiskey. Leave your people to attend to those oxen and come in and have a drink."
"Thank you, Mr. Robertson."
"Captain Robertson," he interrupted. "Man, don't look astonished. You mightn't guess it, but I commanded a mail steamer once and should like to hear myself called rightly again before I die."
"I beg your pardon, Captain Robertson, but myself, I don't drink anything before sundown. However, if you have something to eat..."
"Oh yes, Inez, she's my daughter, will find you a bite. Those men of yours..." And he looked doubtfully at Umslopogaas and his savage company. "Will want food as well. I'll have a beast killed for them. They look as if they could eat it, for horns and all. Where are my people? All asleep, I suppose, the lazy lubbers. Wait a bit, I'll wake them up."
Going to the house, he snatched a great shambok cut from hippopotamus hide from where it hung on a nail in the wall, and ran towards the group of huts which I have mentioned, roaring out the name Tomaso, also a string of oaths such as seamen used, mixed with others of a Portuguese variety. What happened there I could not see because bows were in the way, but presently I heard blows and screams and caught sight of people, all dark-skinned, flying from the huts. A little later a fat half-bred man, I should say from his curling hair that his mother was a negress and his father a Portuguese, appeared with some other nondescript fellows and began to give directions in competent fashion about our oxen, also as to the killing of a calf. He spoke in bastard Portuguese, which I could understand, and I heard him talk of Umslopogaas, to whom he pointed as "that nigger," after the fashion of such cross-bred people who choose to consider themselves white men. Also he made uncomplimentary remarks about Hans, who of course understood every word he said. Evidently Tomaso's temper had been ruffled by this sudden and violent disturbance of his nap. Just then our host appeared, puffing with his exertions, and declaring that he had stirred up the swine with a vengeance, in proof of which he pointed to the shambok that was reddened with blood. "Captain Robertson," I said, "I wish to give you a hint to be passed on to Mr. Tomaso, if that is he. He spoke of the Zulu soldier there as a nigger, etc. Well, he is a chief of a high rank and rather a terrible fellow if roused. Therefore, I recommend Mr. Tomaso not to let him understand that he is insulting him."
"Oh, that's the way of these snuff and butters, one whose grandmother once met a white man," replied the captain, laughing. "But I'll tell him."
And he did, in Portuguese. His retainer listened in silence, looking at Umslopogaas rather sulkily. Then we walked into the house. As we went, the captain said,
"Señor Tomaso, he calls himself Señor, is my manager here, and a clever man, honest too in his way and attached to me, perhaps because I saved his life once. But he has a nasty temper, as have all these cross-breeds, so I hope he won't get wrong with that native who carries a big axe."
"I hope so too, for his own sake," I replied emphatically. The captain led the way into the sitting room. There was but one in the house. It proved a queer kind of place, with rude furniture seated with strips of hide after the Boer fashion, and yet bearing a certain air of refinement, which was doubtless due to Inez, who, with the assistance of a stout native girl, was already engaged in setting the table. Thus there was a shelf with books. Shakespeare was one of these, I noticed.
over which hung an ivory crucifix which suggested that Inez was a Catholic. On the walls, too, were some good portraits, and on the window ledge a jar full of flowers. Also, the forks and spoons were of silver, as were the mugs, and engraved with a tremendous coat of arms and a Portuguese motto. Presently the food appeared, which was excellent and plentiful, and the captain, his daughter, and I sat down and ate. I noted that he drank gin and water, an innocent-looking beverage, but strong as he took it. It was offered to me, but like Miss Inez, I preferred coffee. During the meal and afterwards, while we smoked upon the veranda, I told them as much as I thought desirable of my plans. I said that I was engaged upon a journey of exploration of the country beyond the Zambesi, and that having heard of this settlement, which, by the way, was called Strathmuir, as I gathered after a place in faraway Scotland, where the captain had been born and passed his childhood, I had come here to inquire as to how to cross the great river, and about other things. The captain was interested, especially when I informed him that I was that same Hunter Quatermain of whom he had heard in past years, but he told me that it would be impossible to take the wagon down into the low bush veld which we could see beneath us, as there all the oxen would die of the bite of the tsetse fly. I answered that I was aware of this, and proposed to try to make an arrangement to leave it in his charge till I returned.
"That might be managed, Mr. Quatermain," he answered. "But, man, will you ever return? They say there are queer folk living on the other side of the Zambesi, savage men who are cannibals. Amahagger, I think they call them. It was they who in past years cleaned out all this country, except for a few river tribes who live in floating huts or on islands among the reeds. And that's why it is so empty. But this happened long ago, much before my time, and I don't suppose they will ever cross the river again."
"If I might ask, what brought you here, Captain?" I said, for the point was one on which I felt curious.
"That which brings most men to wild places, Mr. Quatermain, trouble. If you want to know, I had a misfortune and piled up my ship. There was some lives lost, and rightly or wrongly, I got the sack. Then I started as a trader in a godforsaken hole named Chinde, one of the Zambesi mouths, you know, and did very well, as we Scotsmen have a way of doing. There I married a Portuguese lady, a real lady of high blood, one of the old sort. When my girl Inez was about 12 years old, I got into more trouble, for my wife died, and it pleased a certain relative of hers to say that it was because I had neglected her. This ended in a row, and the truth is that I killed him. In fair fight, mind you, still kill him. I did, though I scarcely knew that I had done it at the time, after which the place grew too hot to hold me. So I sold up and swore that I would have no more to do with what they are pleased to call civilization on the East Coast. During my trading I had heard that there was a fine country up this way, and here I came and settled years ago, bringing my girl and Tommaso, who was one of my managers, also a few other people with me. And here I have been ever since, doing very well as before. For I trade a lot of ivory and other things, and grow stuff and cattle, which I sell to the river natives. Yes, I'm a rich man now, and could go to live on my means in Scotland, or anywhere."
"Why don't you?" I asked.
"Oh, for many reasons. I've lost touch with all that, and become a half wild, and I like this life, and the sunshine, and being my own master. Also, if I did, things might be raked up against me about that man's death. Also, though I dare say it will make you think badly of me for it, Mr. Quatermain, I have ties down there," and he waved his hand towards the village, if so it could be called, "which it wouldn't be easy for me to break. A man may be fond of his children, Mr. Quatermain. even if their skins ain't so white as they ought to be. Lastly, I have habits, you see. I'm speaking out to you as man to man, which might get me into trouble again if I went back to the world." And he nodded his fine, capable-looking head in the direction of the bottle on the table. "I see," I said hastily, for this kind of confession bursting out of the man's lonely heart when what he had drunk took hold of him was painful to hear. "But how about your daughter, Miss Inez?" "Ah," he said with a quiver in his voice, "there you touch it. She ought to go away. There is no one for her to marry here, where we haven't seen a white man for years, and she's a lady right enough, like her mother. But who is she to go to, being a Roman Catholic, whom my own dour Presbyterian folk in Scotland, if any of them are left, would turn their backs on? Moreover, she loves me in her own fashion, as I love her, and she wouldn't leave me because she thinks it's her duty to stay, and knows that if she did I should go to the devil altogether. Still, perhaps you might help me about her, Mr. Quatermain. That is, if you lived to come back from your journey," he added doubtfully. I felt inclined to ask how I could possibly help in such a matter, but thought it wisest not to say nothing. This, however, he did not notice, for he went on. "Now I think I will have a nap, as I do my work in the early morning and sometimes late at night when my brain seems to clear up again. For you see, I was a sailor for many years and accustomed to keeping watches. You look after yourself, won't you, and treat the place as your own." Then he vanished into the house to lie down. When I had finished my pipe, I went for a walk. First I visited the wagon, where I found Umslopogaas and his company engaged in cooking the beast that had been given them, Zulu fashion. Hans, with his usual cunning, had already secured a meal, probably from the servants or from Inez herself. At least he left them and followed me. First we went down to the huts, where we saw a number of good-looking young women of mixed blood, all decently dressed and engaged about their household duties. Also we saw four or five boys and girls, to say nothing of a baby in arms, fine young people, one or two of whom were more white than coloured.
"Those children are very like the Baas with the red beard," remarked Hans reflectively.
"Yes," I said, and shivered, for now I understood the awfulness of this poor man's case. He was the father of a number of half-breeds who tied him to this spot as anchors tie a ship. I went on rather hastily past some sheds to a long, low building which proved to be a store. Here the quarter-blood called Tomaso and some assistants were engaged in trading with natives from the Zambesi swamps, men of a kind that I had never seen, but in a way more civilized than many further south. What they were selling or buying I did not stop to see, but I noticed that the store was full of goods of one sort or another, including a great deal of ivory, which, as I supposed, had come down the river from inland. Then we walked on to the cultivated fields, where we saw corn growing very well, also tobacco and other crops. Beyond this were cattle kraals, and in the distance we perceived a great number of cattle and goats feeding on the slopes.
"This red-beard Baas must be very rich in all things," remarked the observant Hans when we had completed our investigations.
"Yes," I answered, "rich and yet poor."
"How can a man be both rich and yet poor, Baas?" asked Hans.
Just at that moment some of the half-bred children whom I have mentioned ran past us more naked than dressed and whooping like little savages. Hans contemplated them gravely, then said,
"I think I understand now, Baas. A man may be rich in things he loves and yet does not want, which makes him poor in other ways."
"Yes," I answered, "as you are, Hans, when you take too much to drink."
Just then we met the stately Miss Inez returning from the store, carrying some articles in a basket, soap, I think, and tea in a packet amongst them. I told Hans to take the basket and bear it to the house for her. He went off with it, and, walking slowly, we fell into conversation. "Your father must do very well here," I said, nodding at the store with a crowd of natives round it. "Yes," she answered, "he makes much money, which he puts in a bank at the coast, for living costs us nothing, and there is great profit in what he buys and sells, also in the crops he grows and in the cattle. But," she added pathetically, "what is the use of money in a place like this?"
"You can get things with it," I answered vaguely.
"That is what my father says, but what does he get? Strong stuff to drink, dresses for those women down there, and sometimes pearls, jewels, and other things for me, which I do not want. I have a box full of them set in ugly gold or loose, which I cannot use, and if I put them on, who is there to see them? That clever half-breed Tomaso, for he is clever in his way, faithful too, or the women down there, no one else."
"You do not seem to be happy, Miss Inez."
"No, I cannot tell how unhappy others are, who have met none, but sometimes I think that I must be the most miserable woman in the world."
"Oh no," I replied cheerfully, "plenty are worse off."
"Then, Mr. Quatermain, it must be because they cannot feel. Did you ever have a father whom you loved?"
"Yes, Miss Inez, he is dead, but he was a very good man, a kind of saint. Ask my servant, the little Hottentot Hans, he will tell you about him."
"Ah, a very good man. Well, as you may have guessed, mine is not, though there is much good in him, for he has a kind heart and a big brain. But the drink and those women down there, they ruin him."
And she wrung her hands. "Why don't you go away?" I blurted out.
"Because it is my duty to stop. That is what my religion teaches me, although of it I know little except through books, who have seen no priest for years, except one who was a missionary, a Baptist, I think, who told me that my faith was false and would lead me to hell. Yes, not understanding how I live, he said that, who did not know that hell is here. No, I cannot go, who hopes always that still God and the saints will show me how to save my father, even though it be with my blood. And now I have said too much to you, who are quite a stranger. Yet, I do not know why, I feel that you will not betray me, and, what is more, that you will help me if you can, since you are not one of those who drink or..."
And she waved her hand towards the huts. "I have my faults, Miss Inez," I answered.
"Yes, no doubt, else you would be a saint, not a man, and even the saints had their faults, or so I seem to remember, and became saints by repentance and conquering them. Still, I'm sure that you will help me if you can."
Then, with a sudden flash of her dark eyes that said more than all her words, she turned and left me. "Here's a pretty kettle of fish," thought I to myself as I strolled back to the wagon to see how things were going on there. And how to get the live fish out of the kettle before they boil or spoil is more than I know. I wonder why fate is always finding me such jobs to do. Even as I thought thus, a voice in my heart seemed to echo that poor girl's words, "Because it is your duty," and to add others to them, "Woe betide him who neglects his duty." I was appointed to try to hook a fish out of the vast kettle of human woe, and therefore I must go on hooking. Meanwhile, this particular problem seemed beyond me. Perhaps fate would help, I reflected. As a matter of fact, in the end fate did, if fate is the right word to use in this connection. End of chapter 5 of She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Read by Lars Rolander.
Chapter 6 of She and Allan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Chapter 6. The Sea Cow Hunt. Now it had been my intention to push forward across the river at once, but here luck or our old friend fate was against me. To begin with, several of Umslopogaas' men fell sick with a kind of stomach trouble, arising no doubt from something they had eaten. This, however, was not their view, or that of Umslopogaas himself. It happened that one of these men, Goroko by name, who practiced as a witch doctor in his lighter moments, naturally suspected that a spell had been cast upon them, for such people see magic in everything. Therefore he organized a smelling out, at which Umslopogaas, who was as superstitious as the rest, assisted. So did Hans, although he called himself a Christian, partly out of curiosity, for he was as curious as a magpie, and partly from fear lest some implication should be brought against him in his absence. I saw the business going on from a little distance, and, unseen myself, thought it well to keep an eye upon the proceedings in case anything untoward should occur. This I did with Miss Inez, who had never witnessed anything of the sort, as a companion. The circle, a small one, was formed in the usual fashion. Goroko, rigged up in the best witch doctor's costume that he could improvise, duly came under the influence of his spirit, and skipped about waving a wild beastie's tail, and so forth. Finally, to my horror, he broke out of the ring, and running to a group of spectators from the village, switched to Maso, who was standing among them with a lordly and contemptuous air, across the face with a gnu's tail, shouting out that he was the wizard who had poisoned the bowels of the sick men. Thereon Tomaso, who, although he could be insolent, like most cross-breeds, was not remarkable for courage, seeing the stir that this announcement created amongst the fierce-faced Zulus, and fearing developments, promptly bolted, none attempting to follow him. After this, just as I thought that everything was over, and that the time had come for me to speak a few earnest words to Umslopogaas, pointing out that matters must go no further as regards Tomaso, whom I knew that he and his people hated, Goroko went back to the circle, and was seized with a new burst of inspiration. Throwing down his whisk, he lifted his arms above his head, and stared at the heavens. Then he began to shout out something in a loud voice which I was too far off to catch. Whatever it may have been, evidently it frightened his hearers, as I could see from the expression on their faces. Even Umslopogaas was alarmed, for he let his axe fall for a moment, rose as though to speak, then sat down again and covered his eyes with his hands. In a minute it was over. Goroko seemed to become normal, took some snuff, and, as I guessed, after the usual fashion of these doctors, began to ask what he had been saying while the spirit possessed him, which he either had, or affected to have, forgotten. The circle, too, broke up, and its members began to talk to each other in a subdued way, while Umslopogaas remained seated on the ground, brooding, and Hans slipped away in his snake-like fashion, doubtless in search of me. "What was it all about, Mr. Quatermain?" asked Inez. "Oh, a lot of nonsense," I said. "I fancy that witch-doctor declared that your friend Tomaso put something into those men's foods to make them sick." "I dare say that he did. It would be just like him, Mr. Quatermain, as I know that he hates them, especially Umslopogaas, of whom I'm very fond. He brought me some beautiful flowers this morning, which he had found somewhere, and made a long speech which I could not understand." The idea of Umslopogaas, that man of blood and iron, bringing flowers to a young lady, was so absurd that I broke out laughing, and even the sad-faced Inez smiled. Then she left me to see about something, and I went to speak to Hans, and asked him what had happened.
"Something rather queer, I think, Baas," he answered vacuously, "though I did not quite understand the last part. The doctor Goroko smelt out Tomaso as the man who had made them sick, and though they will not kill him because we are guests here, those Zulus are very angry with Thomaso, and I think will beat him if they get a chance. But that is only the small half of the stick."
And he paused. "What is the big half, then?" I asked with irritation.
"Baas, the spirit in Goroko."
"The jackass in Goroko, you mean," I interrupted.
"How can you, who are a Christian, talk such rubbish about spirits? I only wish that my father could hear you." "Oh, Baas, your reverend father, the predicant, is now wise enough to know all about spirits, and that there are some who come into black witch doctors, though they turn up their noses at white men and leave them alone. However, whatever it is that makes Goroko speak got hold of him so that his lips said, though he remembered nothing of it afterwards, that soon this place would be red with blood, that there would be a great killing here, Baas. That is all."
"Red with blood? Whose blood? What did the fool mean?"
"I don't know, Baas, but what you call the jackass in Goroko declare that those who are with the great medicine, meaning what you wear, Baas, will be quite safe, so I hope that it will not be our blood. Also that you will get out of this place as soon as you can."
Well, I scolded Hans because he believed in what this doctor said, for I could see that he did believe it, then went to question Umslopogaas, whom I found looking quite pleased, which annoyed me still more. "What is it that Goroko has been saying, and why do you smile, Bulalio?" I asked.
"Nothing much, Macumazahn, expect that the man who looks like tallow that has gone bad put something in our food which made us sick, for which I would kill him were he not Redbeard's servant, and that it would frighten the lady his daughter. Also he said that soon there will be fighting, which is why I smiled, who grow weary of peace. We came out to fight, did we not?"
"Certainly not," I answered. "We came out to make a quiet journey in strange lands, which is what I mean to do."
"Ah well, Macumazahn, in strange lands one meets strange men with whom one does not always agree, and then Inkosikaas begins to talk," and he whirled the great axe round his head, making the air whistle as it was forced through the gorge at his back.
I could not get more out of him, so having extracted a promise from him that nothing should happen to Thomaso, who I pointed out was probably quite unjustly accused, I went away. Still, the whole incident left a disagreeable impression on my mind, and I began to wish that we were safe across the Zambesi without more trouble. But we could not start at once, because two of the Zulus were still not well enough to travel, and there were many preparations to be made about the loads, and so forth, since the wagon must be left behind. Also, and this was another complication, Hans had a sore upon his foot, resulting from the prick of a poisonous thorn, and it was desirable that this should be quite healed before we marched. So it came about that I was really glad when Captain Robertson suggested that we should go down to a certain swamp formed, I gathered, by some small tributary of the Zambesi, to take part in a kind of hippopotamus battue. It seemed that at this season of the year the great animals always frequented the place in numbers, also that by bearing a neck of deep water through which they gained it, they, or a proportion of them, could be cut off and killed. This had been done once or twice in the past, though not of late, perhaps because Captain Robertson had lacked the energy to organize such a hunt. Now he wished to do so again, taking advantage of my presence, both because of the value of the hides of the sea cows, which were cut up to be sent to the coast and sold as shamboks or whips, and because of the sport of the thing. Also, I think he desired to show me that he was not altogether sunk in sloth and drink. I fell in with the idea readily enough, since in all my hunting life I had never seen anything of the sort, especially as I was told that the expedition would not take more than a week, and I reckoned that the sick men and Hans would not be fit to travel sooner. So great preparations were made. The riverside natives, whose share of the spoil was to be the carcasses of the slain sea cows, were summoned by hundreds and sent off to their appointed stations to beat the swamps at a signal given by the firing of a great pile of reeds. Also many other things were done upon which I need not enter.
Then came the time for us to depart to the appointed spot over 20 miles away, most of which distance it seemed we could trek in the wagon. Captain Robertson, who for the time had cut off his gin, was as active about the affair as though he were once more in command of a mail steamer. Nothing escaped his attention. Indeed, in the care which he gave to details, he reminded me of the captain of a great ship that is leaving port, and from it I learnt how able a man he must once have been. "Does your daughter accompany us?" I asked, on the night before we started. "Oh, no," he answered, "she would only be in the way. She will be quite safe here, especially as Tomaso, who is snow hunter, remains in charge of the place, with some of the older natives to look after the women and children." Later I saw Inez herself, who said that she would have liked to come, although she hated to see great beasts killed, but that her father was against it because he thought she might catch fever. So she supposed that she had better remain where she was. I agreed, though in my heart I was doubtful, and said that I would leave Hans, whose foot was not as yet quite well, and with whom she had made friends, as she had done with Umslopogaas, to look after her. Also there would be with him the two great Zulus, who were now recovering from their attack of stomach sickness, so that she would have nothing to fear. She answered with her slow smile that she feared nothing, still she would have liked to come with us. Then we parted, as it proved, for a long time. It was quite a ceremony. Umslopogaas, in the name of the axe, solemnly gave over Inez to the charge of his two followers, bidding them to guard her, with so much earnestness that I began to suspect he feared something which he did not choose to mention. My mind went back indeed to the prophecy of the witch doctor Goroko, of which it was possible that he might be thinking. But as while he spoke, he kept his fierce eyes fixed upon the fat and pompous quarter-bred Tomaso, I concluded that here was the object of his doubts. It might have occurred to him that this Tomaso would take the opportunity of her father's absence to annoy Inez. If so, I was sure that he was mistaken, for various reasons, of which I need only quote one. Namely, that even if such an idea had ever entered his head, Tomaso was far too great a coward to translate it into action. Still, suspecting something, I also gave Hans instructions to keep a sharp eye on Inez and generally to watch the place, and if he saw anything suspicious, to communicate with us at once. "Yes, Baas," said Hans, "I will look after Sad Eyes." For so, with their usual quickness of observation, our Zulus had named Inez. "As though she were my grandmother, though what there is to fear for her I do not know. But, Baas, I would much rather come and look after you, as your reverend father, the predicant, told me to do always, which is my duty, not girl-herding, Baas. Also, my foot is now quite well, and I want to shoot sea cows and..." Here he paused.
"And what, Hans?"
"And Goroko said that there was going to be much fighting, and if there should be fighting and you should come to harm because I was not there to protect you, what would your reverend father think of me then?"
All of which meant two things: that Hans never liked being separated from me if he could help it, and that he much preferred a shooting trip to stopping alone in this strange place with nothing to do except eat and sleep. So I concluded, though indeed I did not get quite to the bottom of the business. In reality Hans was putting up a most gallant struggle against temptation. As I found out afterwards, Captain Roberts had been giving him strong drink on the sly, moved thereto by sympathy with a fellow topper. Also he had shown him where, if he wanted it, he could get more, and Hans always wanted gin very badly indeed. To leave it within his reach was like leaving a handful of diamonds lying about in the room of a thief. This he knew, but was ashamed to tell me the truth, and thence came much trouble. "You will stop here, Hans, look after the young lady and nurse your foot," I said sternly, whereon he collapsed with a sigh and asked for some tobacco. Meanwhile, Captain Robertson, who I think had been taking a stirrup cup to cheer him on the road, was making his farewells down in what was known as the village, for I saw him there kissing a collection of half-bred children and giving Tomaso instructions to look after them and their mothers. Returning at length, he called to Inez, who remained upon the veranda, for she always seemed to shrink from her father after his visits to the village, to keep a stiff upper lip and not feel lonely, and commanded the cavalcade to start. So off we went, about 20 of the village natives, a motley crew armed with every kind of gun, marching ahead and singing songs. Then came the wagon with Captain Robertson and myself seated on the driving box, and lastly Umslopogaas and his Zulus, except the two had been left behind. We trekked along a kind of native road of a fine veld of the same character as that on which Strathmuir stood, having the lower-lying bush veld which ran down to the Zambesi on our right. Before nightfall we came to a ridge whereon this bush veld turned south, fringing that tributary of the great river in the swamps of which we were to hunt for sea cows. Here we camped, and next morning, leaving the wagon in charge of my voorlooper and a couple of the Strathmuir natives, for the driver was to act as my gun-bearer, we marched down into the sea-bush veld. It proved to be full of game, but at this we dared not fire for fearing of disturbing the hippopotami in the swamps beneath, whence in that event they might escape us back to the river. About midday we passed out the bush veld and reached the place where the dry was to be. Here, bordered by the steep banks, covered with bush, was swampy ground not more than 200 yards wide, down the centre of which ran a narrow channel, or rather deep water, draining a vast expanse of morass above. It was up this channel that the sea cows travelled to the feeding ground, where they loved to collect at that season of the year. There, with the assistance of some of the riverside natives, we made our preparations under the direction of Captain Robertson. The rest of these men, to the number of several hundreds, had made a wide detour to the head of the swamps, miles away, whence they were to advance at a certain signal. These preparations were simple. A quantity of thorn trees were cut down, and by means of heavy stones fastened to their trunks, anchored in the narrow channel of deep water. To their tops, which floated on the placid surface, were tied a variety of rags which we had brought with us, such as old red flannel shirts, gay-coloured but worn-out blankets, and I know not what besides. Some of these fragments also were attached to the anchored ropes under water. Also we selected places for the guns upon the steep banks that I have mentioned, between which this channel ran. Foreseeing what would happen, I chose one for myself behind a particularly stout rock, and what is more, built a stone wall to the height of several feet on the landward side of it, as I guessed that the natives posted near to me would prove wild in their shooting. These labours occupied the rest of that day, and at night we retired to high ground to sleep. Before dawn on the following morning we returned and took up our stations, some on one side of the channel and some on the other, which we had to reach in a canoe brought for the purpose by the river natives. Then, before the sun rose, Captain Robertson fired a huge pile of dried reeds and bushes, which was to give the signal to the river natives far away to begin their beat. This done, we sat down and waited, after making sure that every gun had plenty of ammunition ready. As the dawn broke, by climbing a tree near my schanze, or shelter, I saw a good many miles away to the south a wide circle of little fires, and guessed that the natives were beginning to burn the dry seeds of the swamp. Presently these fires drew together into a thin wall of flame. Then I knew that it was time to return to the schanze and prepare. It was full daylight, however, before anything happened. Watching the still channel of water, I saw ripples on it and bubbles of air rising. Suddenly there appeared the head of a great bull hippopotamus, which, having caught sight of our rag barricade, either above or below water, had risen to the surface to see what it might be. I put a bullet from an 8-bore rifle through its brain, whereon it sank, I guessed stone dead, to the bottom of the channel, thus helping to increase the barricade by the bulk of its great body. Also it had another effect. I have observed that sea cows cannot bear the smell and taint of blood, which frightens them horribly, so that they will expose themselves to almost any risk rather than get it into their nostrils. Now, in this still water, where there was no perceptible current, the blood from the dead bull soon spread all about, so that when the herd following their leader began to arrive, they were much alarmed. Indeed, the first of them, on winding or tasting it, turned and tried to get back up the channel, where, however, they met others following, and there ensued a tremendous confusion. They rose to the surface, blowing, snorting, bellowing, and scrambling over each other in the water, while continually more and more arrived behind them, till there was a perfect pandemonium in that narrow place. All our guns opened fire wildly upon the mass. It was like a battle, and through the smoke I caught sight of the riverside natives, who were acting as beaters, advancing far away, fantastically dressed, screaming with excitement, and waving spears or sometimes torches of flaming reeds. Most of these were scrambling along the banks, but some of the bolder spirits advanced over the lagoon in canoes, driving the hippopotami towards the mouth of the channel, by which alone they could escape into the great swamps below, and so on to the river. In all my hunting experience, I do not think I ever saw a more remarkable scene. Still, in a way, to me, it was unpleasant, for I flatter myself that I am a sportsman, and a battle of this sort is not sport as I understand the term. At length it came to this. The channel for quite a long way was literally full of hippopotami. I should think there must have been 100 of them or more, of all sorts and sizes, from great bulls down to little calves. Some of these were killed, not many, for the shooting of our gallant company was execrable and almost at hazard. Also, for every sea cow that died, of which number I think that Captain Robertson and myself accounted for most, many were only wounded. Still, the unhappy beasts, crazed with noise and fire and blood, did not seem to dare to face our frail barricade, probably for the reason that I have given. For a while they remained massed together in the water or under it, making a most horrible noise. Then, of a sudden, they seemed to take a resolution. A few of them broke back towards the burning reeds, the screaming bears, and the advancing canoes. One of these, indeed, a wounded bull, charged a canoe, crushed it in its huge jaws, and killed the rower. How exactly, I do not know, for his body was never found. The majority of them, however, took another counsel, for emerging from the water on either side, they began to scramble towards us along the steep banks, or even climbing up them with surprising agility. It was at this point in the proceedings that I congratulated myself earnestly upon the solid character of the water-worn rock which I had selected as a shelter. Behind this rock, together with my gun-bearer and Umslopogaas, who, as he did not shoot, had elected to be my companion, I crouched and banged away at the unwieldy creatures as they advanced. But fire fast as I might with two rifles, I could not stop the half of them. They were drawing unpleasantly near. I glanced at Umslopogaas, and even then was amused to see that probably for the first time in his life that redoubtable warrior was in a genuine fright.
"This is madness, Macumazahn," he shouted above the din. "Are we to stop here and be stamped flat by a horde of water pigs?"
"It seems so," I answered, "unless you prefer to be stamped flat outside or eaten," I added, pointing to a great crocodile that had also emerged from the channel and was coming along towards us with open jaws.
"By the axe," shouted Umslopogaas again, "I, a warrior, will not die thus, trodden on like a slug by an ox."
Now I have mentioned a tree which I climbed. In his extremity Umslopogaas rushed for that tree and went up it like a lamplighter, just as the crocodile wriggled past its trunk, snapping at his retreating legs. After this I took no more note of him, partly because of the advancing sea cows, and more for the reason that one of the village natives posted above me, firing wildly, put a large round bullet through the sleeve of my coat. Indeed, had it not been for the wall which I built that protected us, I am certain that both my bearer and I would have been killed, for afterwards I found it splashed over with lead from bullets which had struck the stones. Well, thanks to the strength of my rock and to the wall, or as Hans said afterwards, to Sikali's great medicine, we escaped unhurt. The rush went by me. Indeed, I killed one sea cow so close that a powder from the rifle actually burned its hide, but it did go by, leaving us untouched. All, however, were not so fortunate, since of the village natives two were trampled to death, while a third had his leg broken. Also, and this was really amusing, a bewildered bull charging at full speed crashed into the trunk of Umslopogaas' tree, and, as it was not very thick, snapped it in two. Down came the top, in which the dignified chief was ensconced like a bird in a nest, though at that moment there was precious little dignity about him. However, except for scratches, he was not hurt, as the hippopotamus had other business in urgent need of attention, and did not stop to settle with him.
"Such are the things which happen to a man who mixes himself up with matters of which he knows nothing," said Umslopogaas sententiously out to me afterwards.
But all the same, he could never bear any allusion to this tree-climbing episode in his martial career, which, as it happened, had taken place in full view of his retainers, among whom it remained the greatest of jokes. Indeed, he wanted to kill a man, the wag of the party, who gave him a slang name, which, being translated, means, "He who is so brave that he dares to ride a water horse up a tree." It was all over at last, for which I thanked Providence devoutly. A good many of the sea cows were dead. I think 21 was out exact bag, but the majority of them had escaped in one way or another, many, as I fear, wounded. I imagine that at the last the bulk of the herd overcame its fears and, swimming through our screen, passed away down the channel. At any rate, they were gone, and having ascertained that there was nothing to be done for the man who had been trampled on my side of the channel, I crossed in the canoe with the object of returning quietly to our camp to rest. But as yet there was to be no quiet for me, for there I found Captain Robertson, who I think had been refreshing himself out of a bottle, and was in great state of excitement about a native who had been killed near him, who was a favourite of his, and another whose leg was broken. He declared vehemently that the hippopotamus which had done this had been wounded and rushed into some bushes a few hundred yards away, and that he meant to take vengeance upon it. Indeed, he was just setting off to do so. Seeing his agitated state, I thought it wisest to follow him. What happened need not to be set out in detail. It is sufficient to say that he found that hippopotamus and blazed both barrels at it in the bushes, hitting it, but not seriously. Out lumbered the creature with its mouth open, wishing to escape. Robertson turned to fly as he was in its path, but from one cause or another tripped and fell down. Certainly he would have been crushed beneath its huge feet had I not stepped in front of him and sent two solid 8-bore bullets down that yawning throat, killing it dead within 3 feet of where Robertson was trying to rise, and, I may add, of myself. This narrow escape sobered him, and I'm bound to say that his gratitude was profuse.
"You are a brave man," he said, "and had it not been for you, by now I should be wherever bad people go. I'll not forget it, Mr. Quatermain. And if ever you want anything that John Robertson can give, why, it's yours."
"Very well," I answered, being seized by an inspiration. "I do want something that you can give easily enough."
"Give it a name, and it is yours, half my place, if you like."
I went on as I slipped new cartridges into the rifle, "I want you to promise to give up drink, for your daughter's sake. That's what nearly did for you just now, you know."
"Man, you ask a hard thing," he said slowly. "But, by God, I'll try for her sake, and for yours too."
Then I went to help set the leg of the injured man, which was all the rest I got that morning. End of chapter 6 of She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Read by Lars Rolander.
"I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights."
"Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue one last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.